Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. And as you see, I changed a bit the title because hearing the lectures, I was thinking about what memory really is and, well, let's discuss it in the context of protein. So when we look at protein, we see this complex physical object. It is made of hundreds to thousands of amino acids that fold and form this complex three-dimensional arrangement. And we know a lot about structure, genetics, function of proteins, but due to this complexity, simple principles are hard to find. And the main obstacles are that proteins are non-random and information-rich because they are selected by evolution. They're also small and very heterogeneous. There are 20 amino acids, and the system is too small to use standard statistical mechanics. On top of that, the interactions within the proteins are collective and weak. And if it's not enough, you have also the slow pace of evolution, which means that there are very strong memory effects. So understanding proteins remains a challenge. The main question about proteins is how the collective physical interactions are encoded in the genotype. In other words, what is the genotype to phenotype map? And in particular, when we go from gene to function, we see huge dimensional reduction. On the side of the gene, the number of degrees of freedom is at least the number of amino acids or the length of the gene. On the side of the function, we can describe the phenotype of, let's say, enzyme pretty well by only a few kinetic parameters, right? Michaelis-Menten curve is described by affinity and catalytic activity, which corresponds to a simple one-dimensional energy landscape. So there is this huge dimensional reduction, which is a hallmark of the genotype to phenotype map, which is yet to be understood. Another thing that we know about protein is that many of them move during their function. Here are a few examples. In the mechanism of induced fit, enzyme will tend to deform upon binding to its ligand. It will close on the ligand before it catalyzes it. Allostery, another very general mechanism. In allostery, binding at one site of the protein will induce a response at a distant site, probably by some long-range mechanical interactions. And there are many other examples, ion channels, the ribosome moves quite a bit during translation. It's a very general phenomenon. Proteins move during their function. So not only the dynamic phenotype of the proteins are very collective, the genotypes are also remarkably collective, and this can be used by many people to deduce structure and function of proteins. So one takes a family of proteins, aligns the sequences, and calculates the correlation, and this can give very valuable information about structure and function of proteins. Here are two prominent examples. You can calculate three-dimensional contacts between amino acids and thereby predict the structure of protein. Another interesting result is the prediction of co-evolving sets of amino acids called sectors that have common function. And this question of correlation, interaction between mutation, is related to the term epistasis, which is interaction among mutations. This is a very important determinant of evolution, which it's the basis of the genotype to phenotype map. So today I will briefly discuss some work we've been doing, thinking about proteins and trying to find some simplicity within this complexity. And the basic idea is that instead of looking at the structure itself, we look at the change of the structure, at the dynamics. And this highlights conformational changes that are relevant to the function of protein. And it allows us to give some mechanical interpretation to evolution, if you believe this minimal model that we suggest. So what we do is, well, we calculate the displacement. To calculate the displacement, you take a few structures, known structures of the protein, let's say from crystallography or from NMR, and you calculate the difference. The difference, of course, gives you the displacement. For example, if you look at this enzyme called glucokinase, and you compare two structures, one bound to glucose, this is an enzyme that catalyzes glucose, so we have one structure that is bound to glucose, another free structure, you calculate the difference, and you get a displacement, these are these arrows. You see that there is displacement, a very significant displacement all over the protein. It's a global conformational change. The displacement is something around 3 to 5 angstrom all over the protein. And, well, you can use this displacement to understand the mechanics of protein. The more useful quantity is not the displacement itself. Of course, all of you know that to see where local rearrangement occurs, you look at the gradient of the motion, the shear tensor, and if the shear is high, it means that there is local rearrangement. If the shear is zero, it means that this part of the protein moves like a rigid body. So you see that while all the protein moves during this motion of binding, the shear, the local rearrangement, is localized along this interface that separates the protein into two rigid subdomains that move with respect to each other. Well, except for the shear, there is also some very interesting non-affine component to this motion that indicates some plasticity, but that's a different story. Here is another example. This is hemoglobin. So hemoglobin, it's the classical example for an allosteric protein. It is made of four subunits, two alphas and two betas. And the red interface is the high shear region, and you see that it separates this hemoglobin in the middle, and you can estimate the dimension of this high shear region. It's more or less about two. It's approximately a two-dimensional structure. You can calculate similarly the dimension of high shear regions in other protein, and it turns out that they are all around two. It's about roughly a two-dimensional object that separates the protein. Fractal dimension, yeah, the correlation dimension.
Are these big enough systems to that makes any sense?
I'm confused. What is the statement you're making? Are you making the statement that there are proteins which show this feature, or are you saying that this is somehow a general feature of allostery?
That's a very good question. How general is this conjecture? So I think it's general. We don't have a proof. In many cases we looked at it, it looks like that. But
if you want to minimize the number of degrees of freedom and to change the shape, is a two-dimensional surface the lowest you can get? Do you have a gut feeling for why it's two? Are you going to spend the rest of your talk talking about this, or waste?
But No, it's a very good question. I never thought about the question of what would be.
I had a one-dimensional thing where yes. Fear was happening. You can't do much. A two-dimensional sheet, you can sort of fold things.
Well.
It's a question of what are the things you might want to do. I think that's sort of implicitly what I was asking.
Okay. I think it depends a lot.
No,
it's very interesting. I like to be distracted. Yeah. So, yeah, I know this talk. So that's a. So thank you for the question.
That's the last interesting thing you bring up.
So here's another interesting fact, I think. So one way to measure the forces that cause this shear in the protein was recently devised by Giovanni Zocchi. It's a very elegant method to measure small forces that take place inside the protein. So what they do is to take an enzyme, bind it at one side to a surface, and at the other side, I didn't draw it, there is a large gold particle which is charged by DNA, and now you can apply frequency-dependent electric field and measure the frequency response, like you do usually in rheology. So this is nanorheology because it's a very small object, and you can look at the response, the formation curve of the protein as a function of the frequency, and at a very good resolution, sub-angstrom resolution, because you average over many proteins on the surface. And what they have seen is the following. They have seen that at high frequencies, protein behave like spring. They basically vibrate with the frequency. But as you go to lower frequency, they are no longer springs. They start to flow. They behave like viscous fluid, if you wish, as you see from the divergence of the deformation curve in the region of, let's say, 30 hertz, around 30 hertz. Yes?
So there will be some frequency in which the gold particle just drags the whole protein around, and then it will look viscous for trivial reasons.
Why frequency?
I assume that the electric field pulls the gold particle.
Yes.
Gold particle attached to a protein which is finite, sitting in fluid.
It is attached to the surface below. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Good.
Yeah.
So what does deformation mean? Because this, I mean, if I had sort of a vibrating system, or if I had like a frequency spectrum, I expect an inverse dependence. Of the mean squared displacement, so I wouldn't necessarily call it viscous. So why are you calling it viscous here?
I call it viscous because, well, the dogma about thinking about protein is that of an elastic network, and elastic network would give you a plateau. So, and this, yeah. This is basically the Maxwell model of a spring and in a viscous fluid. So at low frequencies, it starts to flow, right? And at high frequencies.
He's asking if you apply the same force but go twice the frequency, then you should move less at high frequency. Not a plateau, and
that you see
changing
there.
The amplitude, the frequency in such a way to get the same deformation or something.
So what does deformation mean?
Deformation is just the.
This is not your paper. This is. So we.
But I like this paper as well.
Pardon?
I like this paper more than mine. So. No. The deformation is the distance between.
Okay.
So it's the stretching of the enzyme. Right. Yeah, but this is only the motivation. Right, so now we reach the model itself. So these two facts, the localization of the high shear region and the fact that there is viscous response at low frequencies, suggest the idea that the function of protein depends on the emergence of soft mode that involves viscous flow and the shear band. And to study the possible emergence of such a mode, we constructed a minimal physical model that let us examine this idea. And here you see the model. It's a very simple model. Protein is now a spring network made of, here, 200 amino acids. These are the beads. The coordination number of each amino acid is 12, because this is roughly the coordination number in three-dimensional closed-spec system. The amino acids are only two kinds. It's called the HP model because there is hydrophobic amino acid and polar amino acid, and they make bonds according to this interaction table. Two hydrophobic amino acids will make a strong bond. All other combinations make weak bonds. And the idea is that by tweaking the gene, which means tweaking the amino acid composition of this protein, you can get a weakly connected shear band that will allow this kind of large-scale conformational change. Of course, there is a very long history of looking at protein mechanics with coarse grain network models. So this is a very partial list of papers that I specifically like. I like very much the papers by Alexander and Orbach, because they introduced the idea of floppy modes in amorphous matter and even suggested that this is related to proteins very early in the 80s, and there was the constraint theory in glasses, also related by Thorpe and Phillips. Around the same time, people used elastic network to study large-scale modes, slow modes in protein. They, of course, studied normal modes and suggested that normal modes, the low-frequency normal modes, are relevant for the function of protein. And specifically, people suggested that this is related to allostery, these low-frequency modes. There are a few nice works that suggested that. And quite recently, people started to suggest that to associate the emergence of allostery with the formation of a weakly connected region in the protein. So one work that I know is by Miyashita et al. So they call this region the protein quake. It's like a crack in the protein. Of course, there are these works by Giovanni and his collaborators on the viscoelasticity in proteins, and this strain analysis of the shear regions in the protein. And very recently, there is a group of highly interesting works that studied the evolution of allostery in the mechanical networks that are biologically inspired mechanical network. So there is the works by Rox et al. And then by Jan et al., two works, and by Flechsig by itself. And these all suggest that allostery is related to some heterogeneity, so the formation of a weakly connected region. And we also studied this problem from a different perspective. We were more interested in the general geometric features of the genotype to phenotype map. But today, I would like to discuss a more physical context of the interaction between mutations and to put it in a condensed matter context, actually. So just to put it in this condensed matter context, the central quantity is, of course, the Green function. Green function is simply the response of the elastic network to a localized force that may occur by, for example, by binding of a ligand at a certain position of this toy protein. So binding will induce a localized force, and by the elastic forces in this network, it will induce a global motion of the whole protein. So Green function is simply the inverse of the Hamiltonian, right? So the force is the Hamiltonian times the displacement field, the motion. We inverted, motion is Green function times the force. So Green function is the inverse of the Hamiltonian, which is just the matrix generalization of the spring constant. And since there are some Galilean symmetries in the system, you can move the rigid body without paying any energetic cost or rotating it. You need to project it, so it's the pseudo-inverse, actually. But, you know, these are technical details. The fundamental property of the Green function is that it is a collective property of the elastic network. It depends on the global connectivity pattern in this network. And why the Green function is so useful? Because it defines both the genotype to phenotype map and the related fitness very simply. So the phenotype is just the induced motion as a function of the Green function that depends on the gene. This is the genotype to phenotype map. To calculate the fitness, we say that there is a certain prescribed motion that is the optimal motion for function, and the fitness is just the overlap with the induced motion with this prescribed response, just this quadratic form of response and force with the Green function. So this is a very simple and easy to calculate system, so we can run it millions of times. Here is a typical simulation. We start from an initial configuration of the protein, which is random, and therefore you see that the response is really minute. There is a localized force, but the protein hardly moves. Now we mutate the protein, we evolve it. So mutation means that we flip one amino acid, we flip one codon in the gene, and we see whether the fitness improved or not. Most of the time, the fitness will not improve. It's a neutral mutation. There is a significant fraction of mutations that are deleterious, and these will be rejected. And a very few beneficial mutations will eventually form this shear band and will lead to this the emergence of this soft mode, which is, in this case, this is this hinge motion of two eddies.
Both the force and the response in this formulation are prescribed by you, right? Meaning?
Yes.
The force and the desired response.
Right, but these are the least interesting quantities.
No.
It doesn't really,
You're saying what you're optimizing for is given a response that you want for a given force, what should be the Green function?
Right. So the given force means that there is a specific binding site.
Yeah.
But there are two kinds of problems we solve. Sometimes we have one given response, and in another problem, we let this, the position of the exit of the shear band to move around, because we say it's not just the communication between two specific sites, is just the formation of a shear band which will allow the global mode. I think it's a more general problem, but the results are more or less the same. So,
well, I mean, yeah. Sorry, the reason I asked is doesn't, okay, I would like to know whether
yes.
the shear band forms for a certain combination of force and response and not others, following my earlier question. So
okay.
for any given
yes.
stimulus response pair that I want,
mm-hmm.
is the shear band always the answer?
You're asking whether it's a general solution. I'm quite sure it is not. That there are better solutions, and there are actually more solutions as you go to three-dimensional systems, as one of the works I mentioned by Jan et al. Showed.
No, even so, if it is a very handy solution for a large
yes.
class of problems, that will still be interesting. So it's not asking a theoretical.
Okay. Yeah. Good question. So we have this green function, so we can use the standard toolbox of condensed matter. And the nice feature about the mutations is that they are localized. So they're basically like defects in a crystal. So when we change the gene, we introduce a mutation, the effect is like scattering the force field that is passing through the protein, right? It's like a defect that scatters the mechanical response. And if you calculate this change, you can find that this is equivalent to a sum over all scattering paths going through this defect, which you can find by the usual Dyson series. And this allows you to calculate the fitness landscape very efficiently, as you see here. So this is just the fitness change due to all possible one codon mutations in the protein. And you see that the effect of mutation is neutral in most of the protein, but it's very significant within the shear band because these bonds are stretched, and every mutation changes the response very significantly, and specifically the response is strong in the entrance and the exit positions of the shear band. There you get the maximal response. Now, as you let the evolution reach a solution, you find that the protein undergoes a topological transition when you have this new zero mode, right? Before the solution is reached, you have only the rigid body symmetries, rotation, and translation. And once you form a shear band, you have a new mode where you can move the two rigid subdomains with respect to each other. And this you can see if you measure the average shear in the protein, you see a jump that occurs in the average shear in the protein, and this corresponds to the formation of the shear band. And around this region, the fitness of the system will also diverge because the system is proportional to the inverse of the energy of the mode that approaches zero, and therefore it also diverges. When you follow these evolution experiments, you can run many of them. So we run million evolution experiments, and we look at the correlation in the genes, right? So we have this huge matrix of 200, that's a vector of one protein. We have million solutions, and we can calculate the correlations, right? Just in the spirit of normal sequence alignment, we calculate the correlation between two positions in the genes. We find that this correlation also increases when the protein reaches this topological phase transition, this solution, as you can also see from the spatial profiles of the correlation inside the shear band. So now going back to epistasis, the interaction between mutation, within this mechanical simple model, we can calculate it very easily. So epistasis is defined as the deviation of the combined effect of two mutations from linearity. It's the non-linearity of the fitness function. And if we use this Green function expression that we got for the fitness, we find that epistasis is actually the curvature tensor of the Green functions in the space of all possible genes. And it's also equivalent to sum over all the scattering paths that go between these two defects in the protein, which is also something you can express in terms of a Dyson series. When you do this calculation and calculate the two objects, the correlation in the gene, just the correlation between the sequences, and this non-linearity of the fitness, the epistasis, you see a very tight correspondence in the patterns of epistasis and correlation. So this index runs in the protein like this. So this means that the region of the band is somewhere here, the shear band is here. And there you see strong epistasis and strong gene correlation. And you even see the periodicity, which is just the size of the protein. See very strong correlations between the two, which suggests that correlation that we see in real protein, perhaps it has its origin in long-range interactions, mechanical interactions inside the protein. This is just the profile of the epistasis for one location. So let's say that I is constant, it's the position of this vector, and now we try all possible J's with this I, all possible cases of epistasis, and again you see that the landscape of epistasis is very much localized within this shear band. Now, as usual, when you want to understand what are the basic degrees of freedom in the system, you do some normal mode analysis. In this case, we take the correlation matrix and do the singular value decomposition. That's really bad. It's my iPhone. So back to the normal mode. We take the matrices of the genes and of the phenotype. So for the phenotype, you can take the displacement field or its derivative, the shear, and you calculate the spectrum of genotype and phenotype. You find that most of the spectrum is very similar to spectrum of a random matrix, but a few outliers, a few high eigenvalues, capture most of the variation in the system. Here you see the first non-random eigenvectors in the gene and in the phenotype. And you see that there is an interesting correspondence between the eigenvectors of the genotype to these of the shear field. There's a very nice correspondence in the patterns.
Yes. This is your simulated genes, it's simulated shear.
Yes.
You take the S, that's how you get a million of them.
Yeah, of course.
And then the middle four figures are the dominant first four singular values?
Yes. Yes.
Cool.
Right. So you see that the first one is, of course, the hinge motion, but you also have some shear mode and another. Right? And you see the corresponding shear fields.
These are zero
modes,
no energy cost.
Okay, so this is a very good question because it forces me to make the distinction between this spectrum, which is the spectrum from correlation of all solutions, to the mechanical spectrum of one solution, which is a totally different object. So in the mechanical spectrum, there are zero modes that will correspond more or less to the first mode of this, to the average mode. But these are not zero modes. These are actually modes with a high eigenvalue, which means that they capture a lot of the variation of the clouds of solution so in
each of the things is has a shear band that's doing this.
Yes.
But some of them have bigger motions in this direction and some of them are smaller, and that's what's captured by number one. Number two is some of them have things that are doing this more than others, and that's captured by number two. The singular vectors are capturing the variations in the solutions he got from the singular from one run to another in this Monte Carlo.
Thank you. You answered it much better than me. Yeah. we may use you in the following.
You're suggesting you can measure the phenotype by measuring the coordinates along these four directions, and those are the things that mostly change as you change from one protein. One of your design proteins for a given function to another. And you're not showing the singular vectors for the genotypes.
These are the singular vector for the genotype.
Okay.
I just plot them, inside the protein.
Okay, sorry. I didn't know.
So we can see that the gene and the shear correspond to each other.
Got it.
So the singular value decomposition you're doing in the fitness genotype space?
We're doing it in both spaces, in genotype and in phenotype.
You could take the two-dimensional space for the first two and then look in that two-dimensional space for the fitnesses that you got and see if the fitnesses are fairly uniform along this surface of maximum variation, or whether there's interesting features with higher entropy with lower fitness or something.
We did that actually. So it's fairly flat, but there are some features.
Okay.
So here is another way to understand the geometry of the genotype to phenotype map. We just take these eigenvectors as coordinates and plot the cloud of million solutions in these coordinates. And these are just two cross sections in the genotype space and in the phenotype space. So along the third direction and the hundredth direction, for some reason, because hundredth direction is some representative of random eigenvectors. So you see that in genotype space, you get something that looks like a spheroid, which means that all directions are filled. It fills all the directions. While in phenotype space, if you plot it in the SVD coordinates, you get a very flat disk. Actually, only 15 directions are significant. In all other directions, is very thin. And this is another manifestation of this dimensional reduction. And the origin of this reduction is, of course, mechanics, right? Because the mechanical interaction is communicated between neighboring amino acids, which means that the regions of shear band and rigidity should both be continuous. So this is a very strong constraint on the phenotype, which means that your dimension will be significantly reduced, while in the genotype you can introduce localized mutations inside the rigid regions, and they will change nothing in the motion. So you have a lot of freedom in the genotype. So of course, dimensional reduction is not at all unique to protein. Here are just two random examples. So there is dimensional reduction in the expression levels of proteins in bacteria. You can plot the response of thousands of protein expressed in bacteria, and they follow something that looks approximately like a one-dimensional line. We also looked at the phenotype of a certain important enzyme called Rubisco, and we found that all values of kinetic parameters of this protein. There are four of them. They all reside along one dimensional line. It looks like a general phenomenon, so I think it's a good time to start and summarize. So to summarize, we've seen that genotype and phenotype are linked by some mechanical minimal model, by these mechanical propagators, the green function. Mutation in this interpretation is just a mechanical defect. Mutations interact by multiple scattering. This is epistasis. Genotype to phenotype map and fitness lexic are shaped by these scattering pathways. This explains the emergence of soft modes when a topological transition occurs. It also explains why there is dimensional reduction because of the huge mechanical constraints, which leads to this correspondence between the mechanical modes and the coevolution modes, the modes of sequence correlation and modes of mechanical motion. And perhaps this whole framework is applicable to other strongly coupled living systems. So just to summarize the main very simple idea, that looking at the dynamics of protein gives a very intuitive physical picture of protein that may explain basic features of the genotype to phenotype map. And you know, it suggests that we may put protein in the framework of condensed matter as a phase of evolving, or if you wish, learning amorphous matter, and use the same toolbox of condensed matter to understand the basics of protein. And most importantly, I would like to thank the people who did this work: Sandeep Panduta, my postdoc at IBS, Jean-Pierre Ekman in Geneva, Albert Lipshaber in Rockefeller, and Stan Leibler and Michael Mitchell in IIS and Rockefeller. And thank you.
Questions?
So is your interaction between the source and the target symmetrical? That is, if you do something at the target, do you get the same thing at the source, or is it a one-way thing? That is, that you have to start with the source to get the target. I mean, if it's really a mechanical a mechanism that is a zero-frequency mode, it would be equal. Way, but so are you designing things that have to be symmetric between those two?
By the symmetries of the spring, it must be symmetric. So it is. I mean, you can put the force and the response at the binding site, and
But if it weren't a zero frequency mode, it wouldn't have to be that way.
It wouldn't, but.
And so the question is. Are real proteins that way, or are that the source allows the target to do something, but doing something at the target doesn't necessarily make the source do it?
I think you're saying that any linear system will have some kind of symmetry between the Hamiltonian for a linear system is symmetric.
No, I mean, if I do something at the source and I put in energy at the source, I can make, so take a scissors. I mean, I do something at the source and the scissors are very floppy. If I'm not doing anything, I can open up the scissors as much as I want. But if the scissors are sloppy.
Asymmetry is more complicated, but there is some kind of, if I'm in one end of the room and I talk and you can hear me and you talk and I can hear you, there's some symmetry.
You ask whether once a solution is found and I invert the force and the response?
You've been talking about these really being zero frequency modes.
Mm-hmm.
as I understood,
yes,
and you're making
yes.
that distinction.
Right.
And a zero-frequency mode means that it doesn't matter which one you do. Right? There's nothing that's a mode. It's a mechanism in the system. Either side will do the thing on either side.
We should do this afterwards. There's some technicality about Green's functions that we think you're asking about, but we're not sure. I have an exam question from my Princeton grad school where they said, is this symmetric? And we're supposed to say yes, and I didn't remember that. But
I think you have an
answer.
He says it's symmetric.
I think that I have an answer, but I might be answering the wrong question. So, but
okay,
I would love to continue discussing this.
Yes. Okay. So actually, I have two questions. So first question is about your fitness function.
Yes.
So if I understand correctly, you have a response, a desired response, and some kind of force, stimulus, input force, and you want to map these things together. But I mean, where is specificity? Because it's important not only to have the correct response for a given force, but it's important that another force, input force, is actually not triggering any kind of change, for instance, or in the allosteric change. So I don't see that in the fitness function, or maybe I'm wrong. And the other question is, have you tried also on realistic protein structures to do the same thing? Because I mean, there are plenty of structures proteins with and without the ligands,
yes.
So you have an idea of the response which is needed,
yes.
And you could do this kind of models on these structures. I just wonder whether that answer it can be difficult.
Okay, so excellent question. So the first question about specificity, in the present model, it's totally disregarded, although we now consider it in a more sophisticated version of the model, because, of course, the real fitness of protein is not just responding in general, but responding to the right ligand. And about the second, I'm not sure that I understood. So I could take a similar formalism and, you know, take a geometry of a real protein and evolve it. So by evolving, you mean just mutating the amino acid and yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a very reasonable direction. We were thinking about that. Yeah. It wouldn't really cost much more than, you know, because at this level of coarse-grained models, it's the same order of magnitude of calculation.
So is there experimental evidence that would go in the direction of showing that the way in which your mutation, some parameter like the number of the H and the P amino acids or some arrangement of how what you actually find as a solution. Is there a way you can find analogies in the real world?
That's, of course, the most important question. So the answer is partial. What you can do in the lab is to introduce mutations in regions that you think are sensitive and see that these indeed disrupt the mechanical response that you think is relevant for the function. Now, for what would be the ideal experiment is to do a very high throughput experiment where you really explore the genotype space and look for, you know, the effect on the fitness. So there are bigger experts than me looking at phenotype in this way. There are a few people in Paris. I haven't thought about actual design of such an experiment. Perhaps it's feasible, but
yeah, I think the things that Julio Fernandez's group has done is to like take the mechanically stable rigid part of the protein and then do systematic mutations, and if you put a proline in, then you get a factor of 2 in the unfolding force, and like there are certain correlations between changing the, let's say, the PEVK rich regions, which don't seem to have a well-defined fold,
right,
and then changing the ones that seem to be the hydrophobic core, right? There are people who have investigated whether this elastic network idea as a parameter to evolve holds,
yeah,
in the real world, right?
Right, but of course, the fundamental problem is that you have this huge combinatorial space. And even if your experiment is really fantastic, how many steps you can go? How many mutations, maybe? I don't know.
So is everything you've said is supposed to work for those proteins for which it is known that they have a mechanical function and allotropic, allosteric functionality, or is this supposed to be a general paradigm for how to evolve any beta barrel or anti-parallel beta sheet? Like, is this supposed to be an evolution mechanism for looking for folded stable structures, or is it function related?
I think it's very general. I think that there is this division between proteins that move and those that do not, but it looks to me very artificial. And if you really look at the structure, you'll see motions in most proteins. And now the question is, how collective is this motion and how important it is during the evolution? And I can believe that it's very general, but how can I prove that? You know, that's a conjecture, yeah.
So in all this work where you're looking at sort of designing an elastic network in order to have some particular response, so one thing that's not clear to me is to what extent you worry about what else will happen. No, I mean, if it's sort of, if you say that I have an actuator site where I do something and then I want a certain response. This can happen in many, many different ways depending on what else happens. And so this somehow, no people, I guess, who are doing this, I mean, it's very,
right.
It's something that nobody comments on as far as I have noticed.
So I think you're asking about, how realistic is this fitness function? And this is related to Remy's question about specificity. So in this very simple and primitive model, we didn't care about all these important aspects. But the nice thing is that we can introduce them very easily because, basically just a linear system and Green function. So we plan to study this. But currently, we just didn't care. Although, of course, you're right. There is specificity, you need to care about stability, you need to care about many other things. Thank you.
There's one more question at the back.
Okay. So I'm just trying to put this in the context of the other things that we've heard. And I guess, in some sense, the distortion is kind of like the memory that you're seeking to create in your system. So you have a way of generating, these distortions. So it's one step, in some sense, removed. I mean, you could have just taken the original structure, tried to distort it, and then you'd figure out which parts you'd have to break or clip in order to get there. Okay. So there's one level of abstraction, which is the evolution
right.
part. Okay, but in the rest of it, you're basically still looking for a sort of a floppy mechanism to allow you to create this function in your protein. And then the sort of question is, I don't know if it's a question, I'm just sort of spewing thoughts out. In some sense, what's nice about these systems is that in the glassy systems, you have a yield stress where everything falls apart. You get out of the sort of local basin. But in these systems, you can tune where the entire system sort of yields. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bigger flexibility for encoding memories in systems where that yield stress can be pushed out. And so I don't know. So those are just my thoughts. Not a question.
Yeah. So let me tell you my thoughts. So Yeah. These are actually very interesting question, and I didn't show it here because it's only preliminary, so I don't like to show preliminary results. But we looked at the problem of how much information is encoded in the protein during the evolution, how much information is kept about the evolutionary trajectory, which is somewhat related. And I can only comment that the something nice that we found is that this high modes of the SVD spectrum are the modes that change very slowly during evolution, because these are the ones that are most constrained. I guess that in analogy,
that gives you the big basin function that you're looking
right
for.
So I guess in analogy to your system, that should relate to some topological property like your loops, right? So some encoding of geometric feature. And these change very slowly, while the low eigenvectors just move very rapidly. And if you want to think about memory, so the memory is in these few bits of large eigenvalues.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I think we should thank Zvi for a really nice talk. And let's thank also all the speakers of this session. And it's lunchtime, I guess, so thank you.